View Magazine's Rebel Justice podcast. The View Magazine is the only platform in the UK by and for women in the justice system. Every week, we look at the flaws in the current system and solutions that will make it better and fairer through art, creativity, acknowledging trauma, legal reform, reporting, and oversight. The View examines the intersection of women let down by the agencies, the charities, the NGOs, and the support systems meant to protect them, but which fail. Over 57% of women in prison have been victims of violence, women who have been subjected to physical and mental abuse who end up trapped in the justice system. Why is society letting so many women down? We tell their stories and platform their art and words to bring a more human understanding to the issues that affect so many women. The Rebel Justice podcast brings you people at the forefront of the changes in our society today, people on the front line of domestic abuse and justice services, women with conviction and lived experiences, the reporters, the campaigners, the advocates. My name is Oliver Freyberg, and today I'd like to welcome crisis journalist, activist, and campaigner Samantha Asumadu, where we'll talk about activism, what inspired her, and her recent nomination to the shortlist of the prestigious Paul Foote Award. On her article, "Prisoners May Have Been Refused Parole Due to Fake Crimes on File," published by Open Democracy.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Samantha, when did you start your career in journalism and what drew you into it?
Slightly different. It depends on what you mean by journalism, I suppose. I've done a lot of comment writing over years, but what I see as journalism is actually reporting news, thus facts. So I guess my first foray into doing that was about 2010, when I lived in East Africa, specifically Uganda. And I started doing news reporting and news features and breaking news for different broadcasters, international ones mostly. So CNN, France 24, AFP. And before that, I had actually made a documentary for Al Jazeera English, which is what sort of propelled me into news, because I guess people realised that I could film and I could put a story together. Thus, they thought I could do news.
Could you give a brief overview of what is Media Diversified?
So Media Diversified is something that I founded in 2013. How it came about, I'd been living in East Africa and I'd done my documentary in 2009. That was The Super Ladies, about three Ugandan women rally drivers who sort of, you know, have their own careers, a hairdresser, head teacher and a housewife. But they also used to get into the rally car on weekends and drive against men and often beat them. So I'd done that film and I started doing news, as I've mentioned before, mostly breaking news, I'd say. And then at the same time I was doing that, I was actually filming for what I hope to be my second feature documentary, which was called Born Again in the United States of Uganda. And I sort of had filmed that, had been following some pastors, and it turned out I was in this sort of maelstrom about the anti-gay bill. I hadn't intended to be covering that, but the pastor that I was following, hoping to look more into sort of Pentecostalism in Uganda. And, you know, with the context of Africa, it was sort of raging around the world then. But he just turned out to be at the forefront of the anti-gay bill movement, sadly, actually. So what happened? I'd done that. I'd done the trailer. I came back to London to try and get funding to film, to finish my second film. I hadn't got a commission. The Super Ladies was commissioned after it took me a year to get the commission from when I did a little trailer. Born Again was something slightly more complicated. It needed a bigger budget. I needed to travel here, there and everywhere, America, Nigeria, etc. So I needed to get sort of bigger funding. And I spectacularly failed in finding that in London. I mean, it's difficult for any filmmaker to get finance of the scale you need. It's one area where you do need a lot of money, where compared to the writing I do now, I can just write anywhere. But film needs money. And I wasn't able to do that. And I sort of got a little bit depressed by it and so on. I sort of went a bit quiet and started just sort of, you know, Twitter it was quite new at that time, or at least new to me. And I sort of used to stay up on Twitter on a sort of undercover account talking to anarchists and various people till 4 a.m. in the morning. So obviously quite depressed, but it was an interesting political time for me. And also sort of when I came out of that phase a little bit, sort of a bit more willing to see daylight, I started going to anti-imperialist meetings. There was a sort of nascent scene that was going on around 2011. and I met some interesting, very interesting people at that time, some of whom have gone on to do interesting stuff as well. But, you know, I was reading the papers and so on, and I thought about my nephews. I've got five nephews, missed one. But, and I just thought about what they see in the papers and how, what, you know, what options are open to them, considering the sort of lack of black and brown people that were in the papers, writing in the papers or in the papers themselves, you know. And so I guess one day I just started this hashtag called All White Front Pages, because I think I'd read something in The Voice newspaper, which is Britain's only black newspaper, which had done a sort of dissection of the numbers of, you know, the stories about black people or brown people in the newspapers. And, you know, I think over a weekend they counted there was like maybe two stories which featured black people. One of them was about, well, black and brown people. One of them was about somebody who'd started a curry house. The other one was sort of Beyonce. And I thought, you know, who are the role models? Who can my nephews look up to? So, yeah, I started the hashtag All White Front Pages. That sort of, it didn't go viral, but people got interested in it. The Guardian got in contact with me to see if I'd like to write something about it, which I did. And then I thought, you know, let me start a website. It was all very organic, very unorganized, but it's gone from 2013 to where we are now to, you know, quite a few team members over the years following online and offline for the events we've done and so on. And we try it, the rationale for it is to sort of foreground voices of color. So people from marginalized communities all around the world, so we're quite global, talking about everything you might read in the paper, but more comment rather than sort of breaking news. You need, again, like film, you need money for breaking news. But yeah, we've had writers from Nigeria, from America, from Sweden, all over the place, and the UK, of course. And some of those writers that we published and sort of nurtured over the years have gone on to have books published and often be commentators on TV and news. In that time, we built up Experts Directory, which was focused on trying to get more experts of colour from all different fields, which could be farming or beauty or history, onto the news as experts. Because what you find quite often in the mainstream media, especially TV news, is that those producers kind of rely on the same people. So you see the same white faces, the stale male pale faces, talking about various things, which they have very little expertise in. But, you know, they're garrulous and they're very confident. So we wanted to break into that sort of block of establishment block that sort of keeps out working class, especially black and brown voices. But then again, recently, after some work I did some work on prisons, specifically indeterminate prison sentences for public protection, where I found that you get a lot of white working class men and women alongside black and brown working class people imprisoned on this, you know, this very inhumane sentence. And I found that, you know, actually there's not that many people who advocate for white people from working class communities either. And I realized that class matters a lot. And so hence we've started publishing white people from working class communities, as well as other marginalized communities, Roma, travelers, gypsies, and black men from all around the world. Yeah.
And how did you find it bringing these new voices to your public, this transition of incorporating class?
We didn't make a big announcement. In fact, we just started doing it and I didn't tell anybody really. Well, apart from the team, we discussed it. We were just doing it. And then the BBC came along and did a little announcement from their press Twitter account saying that they're going to have at least 25% working class people from now on, which I found quite interesting because I wondered how do the elite people in the BBC know what a working class person is anyway. And at that time we did say, well, we have been publishing white people from working class communities for a while. We didn't feel the need to make a big announcement. And there was a bit of discussion around there. There were some people who'd followed us for ages who wondered, you know, are you moving away from your goals? And I said, no, politically, I'm exactly the same. I'm staunch. I know what I'm doing. And I think it's important to do it. So, yeah, it's been okay. No more complaints since that day, at least. But it might be in the future.
What is the most important news story you have covered?
That's an interesting one because I'd say it goes back 12 years. I did I worked as a reporter, a breaking news reporter, on a story in Uganda. Basically, around 2010, there was a massive landslide in eastern Uganda. What had happened is, and in its essence, it's actually a climate change and climate justice story, because in eastern Uganda, there's a lot of mountains and there'd been torrential rain for days. And there was this little village, I think around 300 people down in the valley. And then above there's mountains for all other sides. And what had happened is, you know, they put their animals and so on up at this mountain where they could graze. And after time, you know, that erodes. And then the torrential rain eroded it more. And then after a time, you know, everything was pushed down and on top of this, on top of these people. And so that was a day a lot of people died. And we as journalists, myself and other journalists, freelancers and also staff journalists sort of travelled up to this area. You know, it took about, once we got there, about 4 or 5 hours to get up to this mountain. It's a really steep and dangerous little road. And as we're going up, all the coffins are coming down because obviously we're a day later than when it had happened. And it was quite dangerous. But why I say it's important is because obviously, yes, the Red Cross and Oxfam were there. Even I think we travelled up with some Oxfam people. And eventually Museveni, the president, did come to that area. But I think if there hadn't been the news, because what we did is, or at least the AP journalist, I think, was the first to get sort of footage out of that story very quickly and onto the news. And I think when you do that, when you make sure that people know that this tragedy is happening and keep your eyes on it as a journalist with video specifically, it means that there's no excuse to not have life-saving measures. So money has to be spent to try and, well, first rescue people, which was hard. There wasn't that many people that were rescued. There was some. I found, actually, through my reporting, it's mostly women with their babies that managed to run away when they knew that the mountain was coming down. But, you know, there was a school that was trapped and I don't think anybody survived from that. But what happens is if you have all that sort of congregation of journalists, it puts some focus on it. I mean, you're not going to know that much about it in the UK. CNN care about it. Other, you know, some places do care about little villages in Eastern Africa. And yeah, it means that some life-saving measures can be tried and also some money can be put in that area afterwards to regenerate because they feel that, you know, people are watching. So I'd say that was the most important story of them.
And what's your view on this racial division in the big media of what is relevant or not to cover and how it affects the general populations here in the UK of what is happening around the world? For example, when the war in Ukraine started, in that same week, there was vast media coverage of it, but there was no coverage whatsoever of the conflict happening in Palestine, Somalia, Yemen.
Right, yeah. Well, I wonder. Well, I mean, what you've described is white supremacy, obviously, and that's why there's a differential in coverage of various conflicts or even various climate issues and so on. I mean, the first people who are affected by climate change are countries in Africa or Middle East and so on before they come here. But yet you hear very little about it and how it affects them. But what I'd say about that different coverage, it doesn't, I mean, for me, I read the news, so I know that there's stuff going on in Yemen, especially. I wrote about Yemen recently. I think that's one of the most neglected tragedies that's ongoing at the moment. You know, they're going to run out of water anytime soon, and who cares? So yes, I know about it, but I guess there's going to be a lot of people who don't know, who aren't so engaged in news. And you can wonder, does that matter? But actually, I think it does. It sort of relates to what I said about, you know, having news cameras and journalists at the landslide, having some focus, some interest in these areas means that things might get better. Not that I think that West is ever going to save any country in the Middle East or beyond, but you can look at your complicity, because I don't think a lot of people in this country know how complicit Britain is in the war in Yemen. And that's ongoing for like 20 years. You know, they've had intelligence agents there for a long time, training soldiers, giving intelligence or human intelligence to the CIA, which results in bombing. They try to back away when they realise that there is a lot of collateral damage going on. But, you know, publicly, they backed away. And they did that, you know, because of some statements made in Parliament, especially by David Davis. But again, I don't think the general public even knew that much. But in the end, what it looks like is they were still doing that complicity, that engagement with all the, you know, the Yemeni, the president, he's gone now, but the CIA, etc. They just stopped telling people. I think they're still doing it.
What do you think about mainstream feminism and how it excludes and oppresses minoritized women and other voices?
Yeah, I always get nervous when people want me to talk about feminism because I really don't feel that I have read enough of the scholars in it, especially, well, the scholars from all around the world, but the black ones who I'm more interested in. I don't feel I've read enough. What I can tell you is from my experience, more so. Let me tell you a little story. So as you mentioned in the intro, I'm a campaigner. I call myself a crisis campaigner when I do them, because I only take on campaigns when I think that they're being neglected and it's so horrific that somebody has to do something. And I'm like, well, nobody's doing anything. Let me try. So myself and a friend called Ghislaine Gnouami embarked on a campaign called Predatory Peacekeepers in 2016, I believe. And the reason for that was a report came out about some horrific abuses committed by UN peacekeepers, which we called Predatory Peacekeepers in the end, we did the hashtag, in Central Africa Republic specifically. But I mean, if you want to do more research, it's happened all over the world, including Haiti and other places. And, you know, we embarked on this and it was, you know, it's traumatic to read any of the material when you're looking for the research because you need all that to be able to campaign. So we embarked on this campaign to try and highlight the abuses and actually to put some pressure on the United Nations to do something about this, to find accountability and also, you know, to help these women and boys and girls that were abused, specifically, I think it was French and some Dutch peacekeepers. And we had some ideas of how we wanted them to be accountable. And, you know, we had a list of this. We wrote in the Telegraph. We had a hashtag and so on. But we also tried to get some support online. You know, we had a petition. Whatever you think of petitions, what happens with them, why I occasionally do them, is to just draw more people in so they feel invested in what's happening, to make more of a noise. Because one thing that all these establishments hate is having too much noise against them in a critical manner. Give them praise, they're fine. But, you know, if you're being critical, it's a little bit of a different story. And so we had, you know, we did approach people who are seen as, I see them as feminist gatekeepers, white feminist gatekeepers in this country, which are also generally also write for the mainstream papers, including The Guardian, The Times and Telegraph and so on. And obviously, so I've come across a lot of these women, these feminists, supposedly, over the years because the media diversified. Now, so when media diversified started, we were, you know, we were engaging with the press quite a lot, you know, because we wanted to diversify the media. Around 2015, I thought, no, actually, they are irredeemable. There's no point trying to diversify the media. So we're just about building our platform and we started something called the Trashies, which is something that was done yearly where people, all the people that they call below the line, the ones that comment on articles in The Guardian, wherever they call them below the line, all those people could finally talk back to the journalists because these journalists, columnists, I should say, not journalists. I think there's a differential between that. Can write about all these people, say whatever they like, but don't have to, you know, don't have to engage with the people that they write about or the people that read their work. And so the Trashies were an attempt to give a voice to people. So over a 2-week period, they could nominate the article that they felt perpetuated sort of racism or xenophobia or misogynoir or transphobia, latterly, in the past 12 months, put it under hashtag, do a screenshot of the article and it will be nominated. And, you know, after a 2-week period, we'd collate all the nominations, put a poll up and they could vote. And, you know, we'd have a ceremony where the worst 3 articles of the year would be, memorialized by us shredding them through a little shredder. And, you know, we'd have the worst paper of the year. And I think around that time, some of the press really turned against Media Diversified and myself specifically, because I was quite vocal about this stuff. And so when it came to actually getting support for abused African, Central African Republic, women, boys and children, they weren't so interested because they, you know, they had their personal beefs about finally having been accountable and being, you know, having people able to talk back to them with things like Media Diversify, the platform, but also the Trashies. And so there was a lot of like concerted effort to undermine the campaign and do and say all sorts of horrible stuff online. And I thought, you know what? I can't, you call yourselves feminists, but what? How, if you're abusing the women that are trying to actually get some accountability for women abused by unaccountable predatory peacekeepers, then I don't see you as a feminist. So I mean, the question you asked is how it excludes and oppresses minoritized women and other voices. I think that's an example. I mean, what I see it as white is yeah, it is exclusive, but also it's personality led, and there's a problem because you shouldn't regardless of what you think of another person, if there is such an urgent and horrific thing happening, which you, with your platform, can help stop or at least bring attention to, which will help stop it in the end. And we did actually, despite their best efforts, we did manage to get the UN to start bringing these resolutions and stuff, despite those people. But you can't, campaigning and absolutely, it cannot be about personalities. It's got to be about the issues. So I feel that white feminism felt itself under attack. I think they feel irrelevant. And it's not about age. I'm the same age as most of these women. And you know what? Toni Morrison was relevant to her age, you know, till she died. Noam Chomsky, it's not about age, it's about mentality. And that feeling of, I think, what they found with Black people talking a bit more about intersectional feminism and so on, is that white women don't feel as oppressed as they were, or they don't feel that they're seen as oppressed as they have been in literature and in the media. And I feel that they felt attacked by the fact that they had to sort of look at the, you know, their own oppressive behaviours, whether intentional or not. And that felt like an attack to them. And it's probably still now. I try and disengage from that. It was a really, you know, awful sort of traumatising thing, the whole Predatory Peacekeepers campaign.
How can we fix this problem of media and reporting systems that fail to hold institutions and organisations accountable through other outlets? Because obviously through Media Diversified, you've done a lot of this work, but how do you think more generally through other outlets we can do this?
Well, you'd have to burn it down, because it's not changing anytime soon. I mean, there's a pipeline from sort of private school to Redbrook University, which by that I mean Oxford and Cambridge mostly, to your first reporting job, or not report to colonialism or whatever job in the media at 24, with very little life experience. I think that, you know, I hate that thing where people say, oh, it used to be better back in the old days and so on. But there is something to be said for people doing like work at a local paper. I think that is where you learn to be a good journalist. If there's anybody working in the press at the moment who is in any way, shape or form good at what they do, meaning that they cover various stories, they look at class and race and so on, it's because they've gone to a local, they worked in a local newspaper, in my opinion. I say that especially because, you know, I write for different people, but one of them is Open Democracy, and the editor there, who sort of got me to do my last two articles, you know, he spent 8 years working at a local paper before going on to HuffPost and so on. And you can see that in the topics that he wants to cover, that he's interested in, where, I mean, that first article I've written for The Telegraph before, The Guardian, etc. And they didn't, you know, they weren't interested in that story, which is an important story. Neither was Al Jazeera, New York Times. There was a bit of back and forth, but they didn't want it. And, you know, that article, that one I took to Open Democracy, is what has got me longlisted for the Paul Foot Investigative Awards. So that could have been the Telegraph's if they'd taken it, but they didn't.
Samantha, you've been shortlisted for the Paul Foot Award for your article, Prisoners May Have Been Refused Parole Due to Fake Crimes on File, which you published in Open Democracy. How do you feel about it?
I'm on the moon. I mean, it's a strange one. Okay, so actually the day that I found out it was longlisted, it wasn't that much of a surprise, because they'd emailed me the week before just asking me, is there any pending legal issues about the article? The specific one is about fake crimes being put on file of prisoners, which stopped them getting parole. I said there wasn't any pending legal issues. In fact, you know, the last time, after a very few contentious weeks talking with the Ministry of Justice, you know, once it'd been published, the senior press officer said, you know, thanks, Sam, good piece. Which I was surprised at, because we've been shouting at each other for a few weeks. But so I wasn't surprised on the day, but I do feel like quite proud, and I'm glad it's got some recognition of the fact that I put a lot of hard work into it. It took its toll, because it was really quite horrific a story to work on, because of the people that are involved, people in prison and their families, all wanting somebody to save their loved ones, which is, you know, it's quite a burden to have, just, but not that I'm saying I'm no savior at all, but also what was, you know, I'm not sure that very many Black women get longlisted or shortlisted or even win investigative journalism awards. So I'm proud of that. But also, what's the best thing about it is I hope and I think I'm seeing it now, is there's going to be more attention on the campaigns that's been going on. So I've been, you know, how it was brought to my attention was by a woman called Shirley de Bono, who's been campaigning against indeterminate prison sentences for public protection for 12 years, because her son had one. I mean, he's one of, you could say lucky, he got out after a certain time, but well after the time of his tariff, you know, and all of them stay in after their tariff has ended. But yeah, she's been campaigning on it and campaigning all for all different people. You know, she doesn't discriminate. She wants, it's an inhumane sentence. They've been tortured in there. So she wants them all out. And so I'm hoping it will bring more attention to her and her team's campaign action, IPP in action, I think they're called. And then, and also to the prisoners, because, you know, I've had, you know, a call from a prisoner. It was arranged by his niece. People are still dying in there. People are self-harming. If it brings more attention to what's happening, I am very happy to have been longlisted again, even more so, because since my reporting, there's been a little bit of more reporting, but people haven't. And there's also been a lot of announcements from the Ministry of Justice and Dominic Raab specifically going on TV, radio and TV, to say that they're never getting out. They're dangerous, which is nonsense. They all, you know, most of them have like stolen mobile phones 17 years ago. You know, there's different crimes. I don't care what crime they committed. They are not in there for that crime, which they committed 17 years ago, which is often not violent in any way. They're in there because they have been mentally tortured, and they're, you know, to the point of some of them having psychosis, the self-harming, and they're saying they're too dangerous to go into the community because of the way they've been institutionalized and affected by that. But that's not the point. There should be resources for them when they're out, that they are able to integrate into society, get jobs and so on. But, you know, that costs money. The Tories don't like to spend money, especially not on working class people. So some of the reporting, it just hasn't, because I think what happened, at least with my second article, is I exposed something that was really quite pernicious, which is, you know, where resignations should be happening, where prosecutions against the people who did actually knowingly put these, because I don't believe it's just bad record keeping, because there was such a pattern of it across different prisoners. Yeah, unfortunately, the reporting that's come since hasn't concentrated on that. I think that is what needs to happen for anything to change, to see that there have been miscarriages of justice.
And relating to your article, how do you see the future of the movement of decarceration and fighting for the rights of people who are or were in the prison system or the justice system in the UK, and, you know, and how we're moving towards decarceration and finding actual solutions to the harm that has been done to different communities?
Well, you say I'm part of it. I mean, what I've done is reported on it, and then I've supported the campaigners, because I am a campaigner myself, but I don't see myself as the forefront of it, and I don't see myself as an expert. There's a certain area that I know of, and I am for abolition. And it's disgraceful that so many women are put in prison for, in my opinion, no good reason, and only making things worse, where, you know, in prison, there could be resources, but they're not. But so that word rehabilitation doesn't really mean much to me, because, you know, there's no chance for it when the courses are not there for them, when the support is not, when they're just, you know, when they're labelled with personality disorders and just drugged to keep them docile and so on. So I don't know what the solutions are. I know that I will, as and when I can, I'll keep reporting on what's happening and hopefully help in that way. But I can't say that I have the solution. I don't really have the headspace for the solution, because I'm also working on other miscarriages of justice, in my opinion, as well. So there's a lot in the UK. We always look so often to America and elsewhere, but like there's some very hidden, nasty things that goes on in the UK. And a lot of it affects, or most of it, maybe all of it affects working class people, which is an area which people just don't care about. People with power, people with a platform, don't very often care about working class people, whatever colour they are. And white people from working class communities are often used as a cudgel or a wedge to try and destroy solidarity amongst us. And we've got more in common than we don't. I consider myself working class. I was brought up on a council estate, before that emergency housing. I've always been sort of in precarious means with money, etc. But I was also lucky. I was born before 1983, meaning I have birthright citizenship. So And also I was able to go to university without having to pay the exorbitant fees that people do now. And so I do have privilege in that way. So that's what one of the reasons I was able to go to East Africa and start working and doing so, because I didn't have the crushing debt that students get now. The only way anything moves forward in this country and in this world is through solidarity and through education, I think. I don't believe that many people know what abolition is about. They just think, oh, you just want to release all the prisoners out. So, I mean, that's not the point. I mean, you can kind of look to South Africa as some people know a bit more about, like, the truth and reconciliation stuff they did after apartheid. But I don't think people are educated enough yet for that to even be, you know, a glimmer in somebody's eye, abolition. But once that education is there, I think there's a chance of more solidarity. And, you know, I've been wrestling with this question for a few weeks, and I even had a dinner party on Friday where I asked the question, how do you get middle-class people to care about issues, about things that don't affect them? You know, while they got, you know, I did a lot of campaigning around the National Anti-Borders Bill, and, you know, they went viral, and, you know, because people saw, they saw it potentially affecting them or their family or their, you know, neighbours or colleagues. Whereas I also supported the Justice for IPPs was the campaign hashtag and name for the prisoners on indeterminate sentences for public protection. Like, we got a lot less support. And, you know, I used kind of the same template to how we did the National Anti-Borders Bill and how I supported these campaigners. And I said, yeah, if we do that, it will work. You know, there's just no way. There's steps. I've written a 14-step guide and that. It should work. But we never got that critical mass of people. They weren't able to get over a certain amount on a petition. There wasn't as many people at a protest. You know, National Anti-Borders Bill, we organised a protest in 4 days. We had thousands, but, you know, we had weeks to do the one for Justice for IPPs, and there wasn't that many people. It's difficult. So how do you get, I mean, maybe some of your listeners can tell me, how do you get middle-class people, specifically white people, to care about working-class black, brown and white people and the injustices that they face, which middle class don't believe they will face? And it's actually true that they don't, because, you know, most of these people who got these sentences when they were 17, 18, you know, at the same time, a equivalent aged person in a different city with a well-off mother and father in an area that isn't policed as much did not get the same kind of sentence. Maybe they got a sentence, maybe they didn't get anything at all, but they certainly weren't in prison for 17 years, or we would have an outcry if it had happened to middle-class people. So they don't see, yes, people, every class, every person can empathise, but if they don't see how it could affect them, I don't believe they will get engaged. So I'd like to know, how do you get middle-class people to do that, to campaign with you?
Are there any specific groups you'd like to talk about that would interest the listeners that have been doing work that you think is important?
So there is something that's been happening recently, because obviously we've got the National Anti-Borders Bill, mm-hmm. but it's actually, this week is the 10th anniversary, more or less, of the hostile environment, which the Tories brought in, and the coalition, etc. And what you've seen recently in the last, I think let at least go back to Glasgow, when there's been a lot of raids by immigration, border officials, etc. And there's been resistance against that going back many years. And I even made a film about it in 2015, the sort of resistance against these immigration raids. But there's been more sort of literally bodily resistance recently. And I think the first that I know of is in Glasgow, when some immigration officers were trying to take these two guys away. And like half of Glasgow went onto something called Kenmore Street, surrounded the van and would not let them take their neighbours. And so, you know, and they stayed there for hours because they weren't going to let it, and they didn't take them. And it recently actually happened in Dalston as well, where some, you know, they went to an area where I assume the border officials or immigration officers thought they'd get easy pickings, but they found that there was no easy pickings because the people in that area all gathered together and wouldn't, you know, let them leave with their neighbours again. And so there are groups like Anti-Raids, Cop Watch, and so on. I definitely say, like, you know, follow them on social media so you know when, because what happens is that they'll do an alert. There's, you know, there's immigration raids happening in Brixton here or there, but get down if you can, etc. You know, but before that, they give guides for what to do as someone who's facing a possible kidnapping by the immigration officer or people who are observing or around what they can do. And I think it's actually important to be aware of what's happening. And if you can and are in that area, to get down there, especially if you're white, because, you know, you're less likely to be taken away. So, you know, sometimes people who take away by accident, is it really accident? What it is white supremacy. That's why there's the teenager, the non-verbal teenager was put in an immigration detention centre recently to be taken to Nigeria when he's not even from there, you know. So yeah, at the moment, I think those sort of anti-raids groups, there's anti-raids Lees, there's anti-raids blah, 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 I think they're the most important site of resistance currently in the UK. There was a call out today, I think it was SOAS Detention Support, looking for a translator to help a detainee at the moment. You know, you just got to keep your eye out. And like for us, Media the Best, or me specifically, like I will signal boost it, I'll put it on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, you know, and make sure as many people as we can get the news to, the knowledge to, that we help in that way, even if we can't physically be there, if we're not in the right location.
And finally, Samantha, are there any next pieces of work you're doing that, you know, we should be aware of and that you'd like to share with us?
Well, Media Diversified is actually going to get some structure this year. I've been interviewing potential board members the last few weeks, months, I guess, and we'll make some announcements in June, and we'll be doing more, publishing more books. So far, we've published mostly ebooks, but we'll be going into print as well. We're doing a few more events. The Experts Directory is coming back as a Speakers Bureau and Experts Directory, so be available for media plus other institutions and bodies who want them. I personally do workshops. It's I do a workshop to help decolonize media and campaigning is what I call it, and that's a sort of 90-minute workshop, just talking to people how they can use media to campaign as well and be effective and be ethical, which I think is important, and just about independent media. My story of how I've done what I've done, certainly not seen myself as a role model, but I have some experience and I'm very willing to give that out as well. I think it's a shame to keep your knowledge to yourself. What's the point? But also, yeah, I'm working on some journalism. I guess nowadays I call myself an investigative journalist. I certainly didn't do that 6 months ago. In fact, mostly I wrote comment writing for a few years. But yeah, I'm working on the three things at the moment, I think, for The Big Issue and Open Democracy, looking at miscarriages of justice, I'd say, that affect working class people. It's no surprise. And, you know, some of it involves police, some of it councils and so on. But I really probably can't say that much more than that.
Yeah, we'll just have to wait for it to come out. Samantha.
So I'm writing two books at the moment. They're nearly there as well. So one of them is a memoir. It's called Between a Rock, a Hard Place and a Dystopia. And it sort of covers most of my life up until now. It sort of starts with my time as a breaking news journalist and then sort of expands out, because in the time since then, 12 years ago, I have been now diagnosed with PTSD. It looks at mental health and Media Diversified and anarchism. I call myself an anarchist at heart and a socialist in practice. That's the memoir. First chapter is called Wannabe, because I realised that, yes, I did do breaking news journalism, but I was not cut out for it. You know, there's points during the landslide where I was crying. I wasn't able to do what I needed to do, and because it was just so horrific. And, you know, after a while, I just thought, I don't want to see any more dead black babies, basically. So I haven't done breaking news since then, but I have done investigative journalism, which just has triggered my PTSD a bit, but, you know, that's for another day. But I'm also writing another book, which is a collated essay, is some of the things that I've written over years, but some new essays that sort of me at the edges of the media, the UK media, having, as I said, been a working class black socialist, anti-imperialist and so on. It can be quite hard to get commissions, but I have managed at points to write for the mainstream media. And I think what I did enhance their standing, you know, writing about predatory peacekeepers. I worked on a construction site for a while, literally to earn money. Not that you know that from some of the comments that were under the Telegraph article, but actually they were quite engaged with what I wrote. But yeah, I worked on the construction site for a while. So it's essays about Yemen, about Boko Haram, things that I'm interested in, things that don't get very covered, much coverage in by columnists, especially. And it's called, the book is called Radical Empathy, The Colonist Class, Egos and Accountability. And, you know, it does feature some conversations I've had with like Owen Jones and Hugo Rifkin and so on, people that see themselves as journalists, where I don't. I see them as a colonist. I think I think it's a shame that that gets mixed up and people think they're actual journalists or reporters when that can lead to things being neglected, really important issues not being neglected because there becomes a zeitgeist where they all write about the same things. We can hear like about trans issues for you think 99% of the population was trans, the amount that's written about it, where, and that's fine. Yeah, I mean, it should be written about it. I'd like to see trans writers writing about it myself. Though I think some of them, my trans friends, are like, God, it's just so much. And you know, there's other issues in the world. And then other things get neglected, things that do affect us materially, like the fuel crisis and so on. And, you know, I mean, that's been written about a bit, cost of living crisis, but so many issues that just don't get a looking because it's middle class, private schooled Oxford and Cambridge graduates who are supposed to write about it, and they just don't know about it because they don't talk to working class people. They're not in their circles. So I kind of look at that in the book.
Samantha, thanks for your time and for sharing your insight and experiences with us. We wish you every success and hope you win the Paul Foot Award, because you certainly deserve it. To the listener, I hope you found this podcast informative and interesting and inspiring as I found it. And listen out for future podcasts with leading journalists and activists. Join us next week for a podcast with Margaret Mehan O'Brien, a leading Irish Reiki master and teacher. Till next time.